The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the podcast that follows the money behind the beautiful game. I'm professional idiot Kevin Day, and I'm joined by the Baron, professional football finance expert Kieran Maguire. How are you, Kieran?
I'm very well, thank you, Guy. Okay. Guy, Kevin, get the name right.
No, I just thought that was Guy as in a kind of young person, like a fan. Guy, you know, this indicates the sort of audience we're talking to for this pod, doesn't it? How's the stomach? Because you were a bit dicky last time.
Oh, I'm everything in full working order at present.
You copped a dodgy pheasant. Bright burn. I don't normally do this, but I want to say hello to Mikko from Finland first, who I bumped into after the Palace game on Saturday in the pub. Him and his mates from Finland, they all listened to the pod.
Terrific.
Which was nice, very nice people. I went back and told my other friends that these lads from Finland listened to the pod, and one of them said, well, they're very long nights in Finland, aren't they? So Mikko will be pleased to know that coming up, we take a look at the latest numbers from Chelsea. Including Abramovich getting rid of managers and how much that costs him, the FA Cup and Bet365 cropping up again, the latest on Southend United, away allocations for cup matches, and why Barcelona and Atletico Madrid played their Super Cup game in Saudi Arabia last week. So, should we crack on, Chelsea?
Let's get kicking it,
did you say? I think it's fair to say, when we talk about financial fair play, Kieran, and finances, I think in recent years, most people's starting point was Chelsea. I think Abramovich taking over Chelsea kind of was a game changer in terms of the way we all suddenly took notice of football finances. But the latest numbers don't, on the face of it, look particularly healthy today.
No, Chelsea in the last few years have been sort of breaking even. But in 2018-19... They lost £162 million in a year, which for a Premier League club, which also won the Europa Cup, is a phenomenal achievement. And the reason for that is that because they were in the Europa Cup instead of the Champions League. Champions League is where it's all at. 80% of UEFA's money is going into the Champions League, just 20% is going into the Europa Cup.
As we discussed in detail on the last pod or the pod before.
And so they lost 162 million. They spent 286 million on new players. And I'm trying to remember who those players are. And I'm struggling. I'm thinking, okay, they bought the goalkeeper, was it Pulisic, Kovacic?
Yeah.
But £286 million is a phenomenal sum of money. They did sell a couple of players and make some profit. So that knocked the losses down a bit. And somehow they got a £5 million tax credit. Which, you know, with January the 31st approaching, I think you and me will be quite happy to get one of those. So that was all a bit strange. So that knocked it down in the end to £97 million worth of losses. So it's a lot of money. It's not the highest that's ever been. Manchester City still hold the world record, because we like world records on this show. But it's a ridiculous amount of money.
Abramovich hasn't been to a game in 2 years, apparently. Is he still bankrolling the club?
Well, yes, he is, and he does it rather through a rather complicated route. He actually stuck in £247 million worth of cash into the club last year. And we start talking about these numbers, and I've got no idea what £247 million looks like. It's just an incredible sum of money. But he does that via... He lends it to a company called Fordstam from a company called Camberley International Investments, which is based somewhere.
Right.
But I've been struggling to find it. This company called Fordstam is sort of his personal vehicle. So he's in for a total...
All of this is quite legitimate and above board, though.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, the nature of global investors and global super rich people is that they've got something in the British Virgin Islands and they've got something in the Cayman Islands and so on. And legally, it's all above board. And their accountants and the other silver-tongued advisors they've got, they will keep them in good stead. So that puts his total investment in Chelsea to just under £1.4 billion.
Wow.
Which for a club he bought for what, 15 million, wow, is a bit of a step up.
In terms of his net worth, how significant is Chelsea? I mean, this amount of money that he's bugging into Chelsea, is this half of the money he's got? Is it a tiny fraction of the money he's got?
I think we're probably talking around about 5 to 10% of his total wealth.
So not a lot then, but in terms of his, which I presume he makes back, he's earning that sort of money every day, isn't he?
He's earning an awful lot of money. I was teaching in Barbados a few years ago.
Talking of silver-tongued accountants,
absolutely. And his private yacht, which I think is the world's first or second biggest, right, was parked in the harbour in Barbados, and he was hiring it out to American millionaires and billionaires and people from the Middle East, and he was making an absolute fortune from that. So he's a smart lad, and although he's got these incredible assets, he does monetize them in a way which we've not quite managed to do so far with the podcast.
I can tell you a little bit about Roman Abramovich's yachts, actually.
Oh.
Because Jamie Redknapp found himself invited onto it for reasons he can't remember, because it had obviously happened the day before. That's a long time in Jamie's life. And he described this, as you would imagine, lavish yacht. And then, so the best bit was his father-in-law, as they were leaving, handed the person who had been showing them around his card and said, if you need the tiles doing, I'll give me a shout. But are there any indications, I mean, this absence of 2 years, because, I mean, he was always very high profile. There wasn't a match of the day that went by without him, you know, being seen in his body. Is this an indication that he's losing interest? Are there any hints that he might be looking to sell Chelsea? And if so, are they a viable proposition?
Obviously,
that was a stupid, second one's a silly question, but in terms of the money it would cost somebody to buy it.
Well, he used to rent a box at Stamford Bridge, and he paid £1 million a year himself.
Really?
Which I think is a bit cheeky of the club. But let's face it, if he stuck that amount of money in, to charge him for his own box seems a bit harsh.
Charge him £1 million seems a little bit over the odds as well.
But he vacated it a couple of years ago, and that was at the same time that he fell out with the UK government. He'd applied to have his investor visa renewed, and this was at the same time, or very shortly after, the issues with Schiphol and Salisbury.
Yeah.
So the UK government rejected that, so he stopped renting the box. He's also had his application for Swiss residency rejected due to, and I quote, suspicions of money laundering and presumed contract with criminal organisations.
Oh, where's that quote from? The Swiss?
That's from the Swiss authorities.
Oh, wow. That's rather bald and on the nose.
It's a bit harsh.
Yes.
So will he sell? Well, everybody will sell something for the right price.
Yes, fair enough.
The stories going around is that he's willing to sell for around about 3 billion sterling. So therefore, he'd get his money back.
3 billion?
3 billion.
That would break any records going, wouldn't it? Certainly for buying
it? Well, certainly for buying the whole of a club, yes. Yeah. I mean, remember, we had Manchester City selling 10% for 400 million, yes. So that effectively valued them around about 4 billion. But with Manchester City, you're picking up all of the other clubs dotted around the world. So there's been a couple of people linked with him. The first of which is a guy called Jim Ratcliffe, who is Britain's richest man. He owns Ineos, who are involved in cycling. And I think he's just bought a French club instead. But he says that nobody's ever paid more than 500 million or 500 or 600 million for a club in total. So he doesn't want to be the first mug, as he would describe a person.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So he's either not interested or it's a negotiation ploy of his. And there's an American investor with a proper American name called Todd Boehly, who owns the LA Dodgers baseball franchise, and he's rumoured to be interested in it as well. I think he's seen the success of FSG at Liverpool.
Right.
So that's where we are at present. But I think Roman's going to probably have to knock the asking price down a wee bit before we get right, any further.
This is a subject we could literally do the whole pod on, but two quick questions, because we do have a lot of things to talk about. And to think you once thought we would run out of subjects after three or four pods. He spends a lot of his money on sacking managers, basically, doesn't he? And the last one, the Conte sacking, seemed to have cost him an awful lot of money.
Yeah, the Conte sacking cost him £26.6 million. And I think originally they tried to fob him off for about £5 million. Conte's advisors dug their heels in. This isn't just for Conte. It will include his advisors as well, and his entourage. But in total, I think we're talking about £110 million for a combination of sacking managers, but also paying compensation to other clubs for poaching. So if you think about Frank Lampard coming from Derby, I think that probably cost £3 or 4 million. When Villa's Boas came to Chelsea, that he had to pay compensation for that and then pay to sack him a few months later. And then you've got the likes of Scolari, Mourinho Trice, the Martinez, Abraham Grant.
There's a lot of them.
There's a lot of them. Yeah. And it is something which is a feature of the modern game. So
think clubs like Chelsea and Watford, to a degree, must sort of factor it in at the start of the season that they're going to get through two managers, so we better squirrel some away to pay for it.
Well, Watford's, I think that they normally recruit people on relatively short contracts.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Whereas with Abramovich, you tend to be on a 3 or 4 year deal because he's fishing in a different pool. If you want Phil Scolari to come to Chelsea, he's not going to turn up just for 12 months.
Yeah.
So therefore, I think it was a 4 year deal. But it's not just Chelsea who are paying out this money. United admitted to paying Mourinho $19 million to sack him. Brendan Rodgers was 15 at Liverpool. Roberto Martinez 11 at Everton.
Wow.
We're talking as millions of pounds without even blinking on this, as if it's the norm. I mean, have you ever been sacked and paid off?
I've been sacked a lot of times. I'm freelance. No, I was once when I was booked for it was like a football fair thing that I was definitely not suitable for.
Right.
And they decided after half an hour, there was kids in the audience that decided to pay me for the next two gigs, which is, that's the only time, but it was probably £300.
Right.
I mean, if it was 19 million quid, I'd happily get myself fired from any job, basically.
Well, same here.
I'm trying to think of other times when I've been sacked. No, I'm freelance, so I'm technically sacked after 6 weeks anyway, any job I do. The producer's very keen to know this, the final question. You talked about Abramovich putting money in. Where does that leave financial fair play implications? Are Chelsea always within FFP rules?
Well, under the Premier League rules, you can lose £105 million over 3 years. Right. Now, in the previous couple of years, they sold Diego Costa, they sold Oscar for ridiculous sums of money. So the profits they made in 2017 and 18 were okay. What we're seeing is that clubs are going to extraordinary lengths these days in terms of financial fair play, especially with regards to UEFA. And the reason for that is that under the UEFA rules, you're only allowed to lose €30 million. So, you know, I'm aware of one club, and you know, I won't say whether it's in the UK or overseas, but one club, when the UEFA FFP inspectors came to town, they employed private detectives to follow the inspectors around to see if they could pick up any dirt on them. And yeah, you know, and the inspectors go around, who's that guy? And they're looking into their bank records, because if they could find something, then potentially they could have a word in their ear. You know, your wife wouldn't want to know you went to that particular club, would
Good
you?
Lord, really?
This is absolutely crazy. And then there's another club.
We need to be telling a tabloid about this. If we want to get that 19 million quid, we absolutely need to be telling a tabloid. That's astonishing.
And there's another club where whenever UEFA come to town, the club's put on a lavish spread. You know, it's a magnificent piss up. Everybody gets absolutely sloshed. So again, a club, UEFA came to town. This club hosted it extremely well. And without going into the gory details, somebody working for UEFA had a one-night stand with somebody from the football club, and she got pregnant. And then she went to her boss and said, I've got a bit of an issue here. And the club said, we don't want to upset UEFA because this guy is married. So therefore, what they agreed to do was to give her a new job, give her a pay rise, and said, we'll fund the education of your child as well.
Holy mother.
In order to ensure that we don't upset any of the people. And that wouldn't necessarily have been anything to do with financial fair play, but it's sort of indicative of the world in which we're living in, that clubs are so paranoid that they'll go to all of these lengths.
I can't remember the question that started that conversation. Frankly, I don't care. But if Guy, the producer, is listening to this, and let's face it, he should be, we are having a special in the next couple of episodes about the financial fair play inspectors. That's I had no idea there were such people. That's really interesting, and that's horrifying at the same time. And that's on the eyebrow meter. I think that's probably top the lot so
far. Yeah, I mean, that final. I don't think it wasn't one of the inspectors. But yes, it was just a bit of UEFA.
Let's just stop
UEFA related fun.
A little bit of UEFA hanky panky. Let's just stop it there and make that two episodes down the line will be nothing but UEFA hanky panky. Now let's move on. We seem to mention Bet365 quite a lot on this pod recently for various reasons. The FA Cup fiasco. I mean, it's for those of you who don't know, Bet365 were allowed to stream all the games that weren't being broadcast by other people, basically, despite the FA's own rules about the promotion of gambling. So how was this allowed to happen?
Well, what happened was the Football Association, they wanted to give people access to matches and therefore allow them to be streamed. So therefore, they employed agents. They employed these agents called IMG, who are, they're pretty big, yeah. They're very successful. They've got contacts upon contacts upon contacts. IMG then went and sold the rights to Bet365. And the rule was, as far as Bet365 was concerned, you had to open an account. I think you had to put down a £5 deposit. Yeah. Now, you didn't have to necessarily make a bet. You had to put down the deposit. And then, of course, you're bombarded for the next 90 minutes with in-play odds coming up on the screen. And this appears inconsistent, the best way of describing it, with before all of the FA Cup games, we all saw the broadcast talking about issues of mental health, yeah. Look after your friends, yeah. And so on. And one of the biggest causes of depression, suicide, marital breakdowns, domestic violence is people who have got a habit. Mm. Now, if they've got an addictive personality, now whether that's alcohol or gambling or whatever it's going to be, it's common. And
we know that there are players within the game who have struggled with gambling addictions and been very open and honest about it.
That's
recently.
Right. And I think for every player that has been open and honest, you hate to think about how many have not. They're young men, and they are encouraged. Yeah. You know, there are people who get commission for introducing football players to agents. Yeah. Sorry, football players to betting companies. Yeah. And then the losses can mount very, very quickly, and you start chasing your losses.
Well, there are plenty of stories, apocryphal or otherwise, of betting companies sponsoring teams and giving players quite a lot of free credit at the start of the sponsorship. So we know it's not, I almost reluctant to blame the gambling companies. And as we've discussed, in 20 years' time, people will wonder why they were ever allowed to sponsor shirts in the first place when alcohol and tobacco companies can't. But it was extraordinary that the FA ignored their own advice and guidance on this, and they've actually been quite humble about it, haven't they? Because the government got involved, and there was quite a strong statement from whatever the Minister of Sport is called these days, and the FA seem to have realised that they've made a wrong decision, don't they?
But they have, but it's a six-year deal, and we're only in the second year of it.
Worth how much, do we know?
We don't know how much, but I know that Ladbrokes, I think Ladbrokes were sponsoring them for £40 million in 2017,
right.
And the FA walked away from that deal because they were under scrutiny at the time. There is perhaps a bit of double standards operating here, though, because if half of the clubs themselves have front-of-shirt sponsorship in the Premier League, two-thirds in the Championship, and then you look at the Scottish League, which is, you know, it is the Ladbrokes Premiership, I think, and you've got close links there. So I think the FA is supposed to have a slightly higher moral and ethical stance than individual clubs, because ultimately the clubs are there to try to break even, and betting companies will pay you more than anybody else, yeah. And that's why they're front of shirt. It's building up their brand and awareness. From a business point of view, you see the logic, but what we are seeing is the normalization of gambling, and kids will be able to name the shirt sponsors. Now, the clubs will say, well, hold on, when we sell kids' shirts, they don't have the sponsor's name on.
Yeah.
But the kids are actually a bit grumpy about that because they want some nondescript Malaysian or Maltese or Gibraltar logo sprawled over their shirts because it feels more like the real thing.
Yeah, and also, I was about to say, they're, as they are in my pub, they're sitting in the pub with loads of adults with the shirt, but they shouldn't technically be sitting in the pub, really, should they? Let's be fair. Another week, another club, it seems, and this week it's Southend United's turn to be in the spotlight. They seem to be in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, the curse of Sol Campbell to a certain extent, because Sol originally was at Macclesfield, yeah. And I think we spoke about them recently, issues with not being able to pay the wages. As far as Southend are concerned, I think some of the players have been paid and others have not, but Sol recently took over as manager. They are really struggling at the bottom of League One, and all that you hear from the owners is, we want a new ground. So presumably they want to flog off the old one. And I think one of the things we sort of probably picked up from this show is that as soon as you start to get property deals taking place with clubs and club owners, that can lead to a slippery slope. So they've not been given permission yet.
Interestingly, I've been researching Southend United for another project, and for the last four decades, essentially, whoever owns the club has been saying, I want a new ground, because it's a charming old place, but it's I'm sure it's a ramshackle mess now, but it's near the coast. It's going to be very lucrative, you imagine, to sell that site. But then equally it's difficult to find another suitable site. So, and like you say, it's so many stories start that way. It's like, you know, Casablanca, Mr. I met a man once. It's like Mr. I sold a ground once. And it seems to be the start of so many problems, isn't it?
That's right. And perhaps the FA could step in here, or the football, or the EFL, or the Premier League, and say, because a football ground is sacrosanct in the minds of fans,
absolutely,
then we have to approve all transactions relating to the grounds, including some of the weirder ones, such as we saw at Bury, where they ended up mortgaging sections of the car park and the ground itself paying 136% interest on the loan. And if somebody from the football authorities had to approve that deal, you would have hoped they would have said, I think we need to wheel back on this.
Thank God the football authorities are all over things like that, eh? Thank God we're in safe hands. Two more subjects. I'd like to know the financial implications of this, as it's been quite highly publicised. United and City in the League Cup semi-final restricted away fans to only 3,000. Yet we saw in the FA Cup Everton and Leeds taking 7,000, 8,000 away to Arsenal and wherever it was, Liverpool, of course. What are the financial... I mean, because presumably the clubs will have to sort the financial implications of the restriction on away fans out beforehand, won't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird one, because the FA Cup can still be an incredibly exciting tournament, and part... We're both keeping quiet on that.
That was one of the worst games I've seen in my life, Palace. Oh, my Lord. Anyway.
And one of the reasons is because you get 10% or more of the ground being available to away fans. Yeah. So therefore, when
And did they, when, did, we may have mentioned this before, but traditionally the away club got the money for that, didn't they?
Well,
because this is why the FA Cup was so lucrative and why people dreamed of a big draw. Is that...
Because of the way that the FA Cup is formulated, the away team gets 45% of the total gate receipts. Oh, so therefore, if you are Rochdale and they're playing a replay at Newcastle this week, they're going to get 45% of hopefully what will be 30,000 or 40,000 as a bare minimum.
So that's regardless of how many fans they take themselves.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. I didn't know that. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. So 10% goes to the FA, 45% to the home team, 45% to the away team. Yeah, the home team deducts the costs of stewarding and so on, but it can be a significant benefit.
Yeah.
To the smaller clubs, and that's why they are desperate to A, host a big team, and B, the thought of a replay is fantastic for them.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamacq, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
So United and City, then obviously there's no financial implications. Is it different in the League Cup, whatever it's called now?
Well, in theory, if it had been Burton Albion, as happened last season, they took 6,000 or 7,000 to the Etihad. United and City have said, well, the extra cost of stewarding, we're not going to do it. So that they are giving security reasons, but it does seem very harsh, because if Liverpool and Everton, and let's face it, they're all in the same city, if Everton takes 8,000 to Anfield, why can't City take 8,000 to Old Trafford? And it's denying fans the ability to see the match. And I think part of the issue here is that United then went very, very loudly on through the media saying any Manchester City fans found in Old Trafford in home ends will be evicted and they'll be banned. But they've created the problem in the first place.
Yes, absolutely.
And anybody who's been to Old Trafford, I've lived in Manchester for 40 years.
Yeah.
I know one bloke who's got access to 80 season tickets.
80?
80. So if United are at home to, let's be honest, if they're at home to Watford or Bournemouth,
yes,
there's plenty of United fans who say, well, okay, I can't be asked with that particular match. I've got better things to do with my time. So this guy, he knows he's got access to 80 tickets. Now, if he will buy them from the season ticket holder. He's got this arrangement.
Right.
He then sells them on to the football tourists. Because if you go to Old Trafford, you go, there's an awful lot of people with half and half scarves an area where I wouldn't expect it to be mainly season ticket holders. If United are at home to Liverpool or City, the season ticket holder picks up their ticket. So everybody wins. Now, the same will have happened to a certain degree for this cup match last week.
It became an issue at Palace for the Brighton game, funnily enough, because it was an evening game, so a lot of kids can't go. So the official club regulations are that if your child can't go with a season ticket, give it to us and we will sell it on to somebody else at the full adult price. Mm. So there were issues with that because a couple of people complained. And the view of most Palace fans were, why don't give it back to them? Nobody takes part in the official club schemes. No one on the turnstile looks up to see whether your photograph's not on the ticket anyway. Just give it to your mate.
Yeah.
Which is what everybody does. But clubs make a lot of fuss. And in the terms and conditions of your season ticket, it's in block capitals. You cannot transfer it to anybody else. But it's like, they're not making, well, the club would make $3,000 a game out of that official ticket exchange thing, so don't do it. But it's astonishing that this chap's got access to eight. I mean, it's clever, but technically the club would be very keen to know who he is, isn't he? as yeah. I'm keen to know who the person at UEFA was, but we'll never find out. I will, off air. We mentioned Bet365 a lot. We've mentioned the Middle East a lot, Saudi Arabia recently, and I suspect the way the world is going, sport-wise, I suspect in the years to come, we will keep mentioning it. As the Spanish Super Cup game between Barca and Atletico Madrid was played in Saudi Arabia. I don't think we're here to discuss the morality of that or the morality of snooker moving into Saudi Arabia and Barry Hearn saying sport transcends politics, etc. But what are the numbers behind that? What were the financial reasons they did that? And the second question off the back of that, could English clubs do it? Could the Community Shield, for example, be played in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, the numbers that I've seen quoted is that the Saudi authorities offered between 35 to 40 million to host the Spanish Super Cup.
So the offer came from them.
That's right. And I think and there's been a lot of talk about will the Saudis buy Manchester United or another club. But I think their strategy, if you think about the Anthony Joshua fight, we've got snooker, what they want to do is to be the place now that hosts worldwide events. And also it was a sparkling 0-0 draw last night, which went into penalties.
Was there resistance to this idea in Spain from the fans, or is it a tournament that they don't?
It's not something they get overexcited about. There were 59,000 there last night, so clearly it sold well. And the Italian Super Cup, I did some further investigation. That took place in Saudi on the 19th of December. So it brings into play. Is this the way of the future? Could we see the Community Shield? Mm. Could we see the Carabao Cup? And let's face it, that's the EFL's flagship, and they're desperate to make money from it.
Well, there was also talk, remember, a couple of seasons back, this legendary 39th game that would be sold to the highest bidder outside the UK as well.
Well, I think the 39th game is not dead and buried, even though we as fans don't like it. I think that was one of Richard Scudamore's ideas whilst he was there. They've got new people in charge now. It's certainly something that club owners are very keen on if fans aren't. But whilst you can understand the excitement of hosting Manchester United versus Liverpool as the 39th game, with due respect, and I was watching Bournemouth versus Watford yesterday on the telly because the Baroness was away. But if that goes to Manila or Hong Kong, is anybody going to turn up to watch it? I think they'd have to work extremely hard. But I'm sure that the marketing people and then the Premier League, if push came to shove, they would do their best, and it would be very lucrative. You get £3.6 million for winning the FA Cup. You get £200,000 for winning the Carabao Cup, but you're getting 35 to 40 for going to Saudi. So, from a financial point of view, you can see the benefits.
I know football fans in Spain and Italy are very, very passionate. But I'd like to think that if it was tried here or Germany, that the reaction of fans would be very different and that English fans would be very, very resistant to what is a major change, regardless of the how important the game is. It's a huge step forward, isn't it? Or backward, as far as I'm concerned, to be perfectly honest.
You would hope so, but if you look to see how compliant we have been as fans to all of the changes, we now accept Friday night football, Monday night football, Sunday lunchtime football, 5:30 kickoffs on a Saturday. We've just said, the TV companies are calling the tune because they pay them out the most money in. If somebody else offers the club a lot of money and the club goes to the fans, for £30 million, we could sign a new centre forward, all that resistance goes. Yeah. In Germany, it is different. In Germany, the fans are incredibly well organised, but I do think that is a lot to do with the fact that they've got the 50% plus one rule and other issues which make a major contribution towards fan culture there, which has become gentrified here in England.
Well, I mean, VAR is a classic example. We had the very funny scenario at Palace on Saturday with the HF, the beautifully orchestrated anti-VAR protest with a lovely set of words held up, which, of course, had to be taken down when Aubameyang got sent off after a VAR review. But, I've got a note here from Guy, the producer, and it says, plug book, plug book, plug book. Now, mine's not out for a long time, so this is yours we're talking about here, isn't it?
Okay.
Us talking about our books.
I do have a book out on the day that this podcast comes out. on Thursday, the 16th of
congratulations
of January.
It's called what's it about?
Well, it's effectively what this podcast is about. It's called The Price of Football. It's there to explain what all of these crazy numbers in football. You know, how can Liverpool sign Andy Carroll for 35 million, sell him for £15 million and make a profit? Yeah, we were talking about Roman Abramovich wanting £3 billion for Chelsea. We must have got that figure from somewhere. So sort of the mechanics. So it's a little bit on the technical side. It goes into the history of why we have professional football in the UK.
Oh, brilliant.
And looking at the wages, looking at how much it cost to attend the World Cup in 1966 compared to what it's going to cost you next summer. Our football players...
brilliant. So this is available at all the usual sources, I presume.
Well, possibly. It's a very small publishing house. The publisher that saw me on breakfast television talking some nonsense and thought, this will fill a very small hole. Ultimately, I am an academic, and it's broadly an academic textbook.
You're Professor the Baron Kieran. Well, we know this. I'm guessing a lot of people listening to this pod will go out and buy the book. I will, unless you give me a free copy, obviously. The Price of Football is a Dap Dip production. We'll be back on Monday for our brand new episode. We've started our specials, which will be the third one. So we're doing readers' wives and listeners' questions on a Monday. If you want to send questions in, and you've been doing it in your 100, so thank you very much. It's questions@priceoffootball.com. Please review us. I say reluctantly because the producer really wants me to say, please leave us a good review wherever you leave good reviews, because that helps with the algorithms. Thank you, Kieran, and thank you for listening.
Cheerio, folks.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.